No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. And I really encourage you to call in and ask questions tonight because we have a fascinating guest. But before we introduce him, Maria, how are you?
Well, Michael, I got my first shot this week, Moderna, through a fluke because the city of Los Angeles miscommunicated with the county of Los Angeles, and suddenly there was a whole bunch of appointments available at Dodger Stadium. The day before, they said they were not going to be giving out first vaccines anymore because of the need for the second. So at 3:15, I got the information. I made the appointment at 4:30. I was at Dodger Stadium, and I was out of there within 15 minutes.
Wow, that's great. Well, let me tell you my horrible story.
Okay.
After being kicked out by the website many times and not being able to get on the phone, I had a colleague call me and tell me that a few appointments had been made available. So I got an appointment for Thursday, but as fate would have it, guess what they're predicting on Thursday?
Another snowstorm.
A major snowstorm, yeah. So we'll see what they do, whether they keep the facility open or whether they push me back or whatever. But I feel like I've taken a giant step forward because at least I'm on the roster. So hopefully.
Now, which one are you going to get?
I don't know.
Because my significant other through the VA, he's a Vietnam vet, he got his appointment on Thursday. And they gave him Pfizer, and yesterday he had every side effect that they talk about.
Well,
he was in a world of hurt.
Pat, I'm not sure which one Pat got. She's a teacher, so she's had both her vaccinations.
Okay.
And she had some side effects, too. Nothing severe, but, you know, she was tired and her arm hurt.
Yeah. Yep, and had nausea and and a little fever and a terrible headache and mild discomfort, you know, overall aches and pains. And that was like 36 hours after the injection.
Wow. Well, this just shows you it's bad stuff because that's what they're putting in you. Yeah. Putting a weakened strain, right? And it's just bad stuff.
Yeah.
Well, luckily tonight.
We have good stuff.
We have good stuff. We have Chuck Hicks with us. Chuck is Mr. Black History. That's what we call him here in Washington. He's on the celebration committee for D.C. Black History. He's on the Martin Luther King Parade Committee, where I've worked with him and got to know him a little bit, and the D.C. Commission on Aging. Chuck was instrumental in coordinating the Million Man March, the March on Washington, and the Million Family March. He is a librarian, so Mrs. Brown loves him, of course,
yes,
as a fellow librarian. And we're glad to have him here tonight. It's just so appropriate to have him on Valentine's Day for many reasons. One, because we love this guy. He's just an amazing human being. And two, because today's the day we celebrate Frederick Douglass's birthday. Welcome to the show, Chuck. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Well, you know what? Let's start right there. You know, Maryland and D.C. have been fighting over Frederick Douglass for a while now, because he was born in Maryland. He spent much of his life in D.C. He did many amazing things in District of Columbia. And so we're both trying to climb. We both try to claim him as our native son. But tell us, why do we celebrate his birthday on the 14th of February, Chuck?
Well, my understanding is that his mother never really knew his birthday, but she always referred to him as a Valentine's baby. And so for that reason, people assumed that he was born around February 14th. She always called him her Valentine's baby. And so that's the date that we look at in terms of celebrating Frederick Douglass and his many accomplishments here in the District of Columbia and throughout the country, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, he was a top advisor to President Lincoln. I mean, how appropriate that we should talk about him now, given what's just gone on in the Capitol.
Sure.
Because, you know, it feels like, you know, as Yogi Berra would say, it feels like deja vu all over again. Yeah, he did amazing things. He was a sheriff. Wasn't he a sheriff, among other things?
Yeah, among other things, he was daddy. He was a whole bunch of a lot of things here in the district. And, of course, he was just well recognized as the first African-American to be advisor to the president, and that was Lincoln. And that was a major, major accomplishment. And basically, one of the reasons that we celebrate Black History Month and Negro History Week, as it started off, it was started by Dr. Carter G. Woodson in 1915 to celebrate the accomplishments of African Americans here in this country. And he was trying to figure out how to make this work. And he figured that, one, he didn't want to do it around Christmas, because Christmas is Christmas, and January was New Year's, and November or Thanksgiving, there was always something going on throughout the year, mostly. But the one thing that he knew and recognized as a scholar and knew, understood Black people and Negroes, was that they always celebrated Lincoln's birthday and Frederick Douglass' birthday, and they were both within the month of February. Mm. So his strategy was that if he put Negro History Week in February, the Negroes, Black people, would remember Black History Week because it would be in February. And it had been just a long tradition of celebrating Frederick Douglass's birthday and Lincoln's birthday. And oftentimes you hear people say, well, Black History Month, they gave us the shortest month of the year. It was not a given. It was a strategy. It was a strategic decision that Carter G. Woodson made to make sure that it would stay, it would stick in people's minds. And when he did do it, it turned out to be a huge success, and it went for many, many years as Negro History Week. And then, as they did the Bicentennial Commission, celebrating the Bicentennial, they asked the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, which was founded by Dr. Carter G. Woodson, if they would do a month celebration instead of a week. And they said, certainly. And once they did the month, it was no turning back. They would just continue to celebrate the entire month. And so that's kind of how we moved, how we got Black History Month in February, and how it got from a week to a month.
So that only happened in 1976? That it became a month?
For the month, yes. It was always Negro History Week, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, there were many people who, of course, as you know, for many people, they had began as we got more involved in things, that there were many other activities that started to happen throughout February, so it was an easy transition because it seemed that there was never enough time to all the things for Black History Week that we wanted to do, so we carried it over. So it was an easy transition to officially move from a week to a month.
Wow.
Well, I was curious about, so I logged onto your calendar, which you're credited with founding, about the Black History Calendar. And then I think you may have just experienced it. It was the Black Love Conference. Can you tell our listeners about that?
The Black what?
Love Conference.
Oh, well, you know, Al Handy actually started that during Valentine's day, and she did. She usually does it a day or two before that, and that the emphasis is to remind Black people to love each other, to care about each other, and to support each other in terms of spiritually, in terms of economics, in terms of health. And so she has been doing that for a very, very long time. I remember when she started it, and I think the first event might have been at the Reeves Center, if I remember correctly, when the first one that she did, some many, many years ago.
Io Handy is a lovely lady, another treasure of Washington, D.C. Let me ask you, today in the Washington Post, look, it never ceases to amaze me that I have a master's degree, that I'm a history buff, and there's still so much about Black history that I do not know. Today in the Washington Post, they talked about Harriet Tubman, who was a spy and led a successful attack on the Combahee River, I think it's called, Combahee River in South Carolina, and what a desperado she was. They had a $40,000 bounty on her head.
Yes.
$40,000 in 18, you know, in the early 1800s was a lot of money to go after somebody. So, you know, I was just amazed at that. She led a successful attack, evidently. Is that right?
Yes, she did. Many of them. I mean, I think it was about 300 slaves she freed. We have her, Tina White, who lives here in the metropolitan area and is a part of the D.C. Black History Committee, and I'm sure you know Tina, is a great niece of Harriet Tubman.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and so we've had her at the African American Civil War Museum. We've had her on WPFW. We had her in Black History Symposiums. As a matter of fact, she was just on something... just this week, talking about her Aunt Harriet Tubman and her spirit, her kindred spirit, and what she stood for. Yeah.
Well, evidently amazing strategist. We all know
her. She came out of Maryland.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, you got Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman both coming out of parts of Maryland.
Well, and then they did the feature film called Harriet in 2019, which I missed, but I hear it's on Netflix, so it's on my list.
Yeah. Well, and you know, since they both came out of Maryland ought to give us one of them. They shouldn't be greedy and take all the important Black people. But, you know, it is amazing to me. And what do you think, Chuck, because you spent so many years being involved in Black history? You know, I remember being shocked when I read the story about the Amistad. Again, it's such an interesting story, but not just because it's such an interesting story and it's a brutal story and parts of it, but that, again, I knew nothing about this. I knew nothing about a Supreme Court case where the former president of the United States represented these people, and it was an international crisis, and there was everything involved in this. How do you feel Black history needs to fit into our culture as a bulwark, let's say, against systemic racism?
Well, I think there is a number of things that has to happen. One, I think we need to rewrite America's history. to begin with, so that we could be inclusive in not only the roles that African Americans have played, but the people of color, period, and make it inclusive and not mislead people to think that America was America because of whites, and that blacks had little or no role, or people of color had little or no role in doing that. I think one of the other things that becomes important is that we need to begin to recognize that we need to share and listen to each other. That knowledge is powerful. Knowledge is information is knowledge. And that when we can begin to break down the walls of synthetic racism and begin to look at ourselves, sometimes people do things because it's out of habit. I remember when I was in school in New York, and we had a conversation with a young lady who was white, and she said that they had black people working for them, and they just did what they were supposed to do. They worked, they picked up their clothes, they washed, they did all this, and they just say, come do this and do that and do this. And she said she never thought about sometimes how her actions were viewed differently by them. She just took them for granted. And so sometimes people have just inadvertently, I say, taken people for granted because, one, they're not conscious of other people's feelings, other people's environment, and it just goes on. And that we've operated in a system in this country where it's easy to take people for granted, to take black people, to take people of color, Native Americans, Asians for granted, because the system has given us, has allowed the white privilege to be everlasting, just amazingly extensive. I sometimes tell people that you can be, I have seen, you know, the times when there are black men, Latino men or women, and they can be dressed in a suit. And it was the time they'd be in a suit. And there would be a poor white person. And both of them would be walking down the street, and he could look at that black man and say, nigga, get off the street and let me pass. It's the privilege of being white that has allowed us to just grab that and not let it go and not understand that, you know, people are human. And that there is no privilege of being white. It's a privilege of being human beings that we all need to share and understand. And that to change racism is work. Because we've been in a country that has allowed synthetic racism and racism, period, to exist from the founding of this country. And so it's a lot of work. It's a lot of effort.
And like you point out, it's misunderstanding as well. I got to tell you, I had a similar experience in college where some kid got up, and I was in college in the early 1970s, got up and said, I don't understand why when I go in a black neighborhood, the houses are so shabby, but there's a lot of new cars. And I grew up as a poor person, so I stood right up and said, let me explain it to you. You can go in and buy a new car with $100 down.
Right.
You got to have a 10% down for a cash deposit. You have to have good credit. You have to have all these things to buy a house.
Sure.
But you don't need much to buy a car. My family never owned a home. They never owned a house. We always rented, but my dad always had a nice car. He was a salesman. Some of them got repossessed, but, you know, you can go in today with $300, put it down on a car, and walk out with a new car. So, you know, some of it's just people don't understand. They really, because we don't explain it. So,
well, I'm we don't explain, and sometimes, you know, and I'll give you a very interesting example. My nieces and nephews and particularly my sister's children grew up in New Orleans and they were all very smart, and they went to the better schools in New Orleans, and they went to Country Day and all these sort of these schools and things. And one day there was a white guy in a class with my nephew, and my nephew always got perfect scores. And so one day they were doing a Black History project, and my nephew got up and started talking about his family history, and he started to trace his family, and there's some white blood in there. And so the guy who had always been bothered by the fact that Matt, he always got a perfect score, he said, "Ah, that's the reason you're so smart."
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you gotta.
You know, now I have the answer. You're not smart because you're smart. You're smart because right. You got some white in you, some white blood, some white brains.
Yeah. And, you know, and so much of this, I believe.
And that's just systemic racism about how people have this thing in their head that if you're white, there's a privilege, you know. It's almost part of this thing that people don't understand about the value of voting and how important voting is in this country. And that when we start to look at and understand voting in this country and how hard it was to get the right to vote, is that when voting started in this country, and there's still a debate that goes on, whether or not voting is a right or a privilege. And the wealthy, when they began, voting was a privilege, and you had to have money, you had to have land, you had all this to vote. And so it kept the common man down so they could not have influence and control over things that affected them. And that's still an argument today by people who feel that voting is not a right, it's a privilege. And it's an interesting concept when you start to go back and understand the power of voting and how it influences all our lives one way or another, either good or bad, or negative or positive.
Yeah, well, we certainly feel that in D.C., Chuck, where we don't have a vote in our national legislature. And all those guys talk to us like it's a privilege, like they're doing us a favor.
Sure.
And when I testified before the Senate, that's one thing I said in my Senate testimony. I said, we're not asking you for anything. We're not asking you for anything other than what Thomas Jefferson said was given us by God. We're just asking you to return it because it is our right and not a privilege. You're so right. Maria, don't let me hog the whole show.
Well, I'm curious, Chuck, would you mind sharing with our listeners what it was like growing up in your household with your dad, who people might not know about? I know he's been gone for over 10 years now. And what I understand that your home was open to other civil rights activists, Dick Gregory being one of them. What was that like?
Well, it's interesting because we grew up as a working class family, a poor family, working class family, but my parents always had a sense of family. We always did things together. We always ate together. We had prayer together. We were young enough and that we could go fishing and play sports together, just did things together. And my parents had always told us, inspired in us, that there was nothing we couldn't do. And so we worked hard at going to school and doing the things that we were supposed to do. And never really thought much about civil rights or anything. My parents worked hard. They paid their bills and made ends meet, and that was about it. And then at some point, the civil rights movement got started in this country. And throughout the country, everybody knew, there used to be a saying, sooner or later, it's going to come to Bogalusa. Sooner or later, it's going to come to Clarksdale, Mississippi. It was just a matter of time of waiting. And so my dad was involved in initially the NAACP. And when they had some of the first marches in D.C., in Bogalusa, they would try to work a deal out for a test case. And the blacks would go in and eat and the Corps was there and they would, everything would be worked out and then they go back to normal. But the young people didn't want that. And so they had, the days of testing did not go well. And days of testing are basically when you go in and test whether or not you can eat in a restaurant. And sometimes you go with integrated people, groups, and sometimes it's just blacks who go in. So after a couple of days, and things did not go well, and Corps was in Bogalusa, and one of the things is that a lot of people did not, our family was the first family to keep the civil rights workers. And one of the things that happens in small towns sometimes is that people are afraid to keep, were afraid to keep the civil rights workers, particularly if they were white, because everybody would know. Maybe if you were a civil rights worker and you were from California and you stayed with a black family, then you could be a relative or a cousin. But if you were white staying, everybody in the black community knew, and the white people knew, white community knew also. And so then you, your family becomes a threat, because this is nothing that white people just decided, well, they're going to have some civil, they're going to have some white people stay with them, and they're trying to change the culture, the laws in this country. And there was a hate, a real hate about changing our lives. What we're giving up, we're losing something. And so our family decided to keep the civil rights workers. And not only that, but my dad and mom opened up their entire house. And so our house became the main quarters for the civil rights workers. And one of the interesting things is that, of course, we had been a family and did all these things together. And all of a sudden, our entire life was turned around. And out of that, to make a long story short, one of the things that happened was a group was formed after days of testing, and they did not go well, and we were keeping the civil rights workers, two of them. The chief of police came down to my dad's house and said that evening that a mob was being formed to come down and lynch and burn our house down if we did not get those white civil rights workers out. And he was there to escort them out. And my mother's first reply was a no. And I asked her why, and she said, one, that she couldn't imagine any mother doing that to her boy, her sons. And two, this had been the time that Janie Goodman and Schwartz had been killed. And she knew that those boys were never going to make it out alive if they left the house. And so my dad said, he said, no, they don't have to leave. This is my house, and it's paid for. And he asked them if they wanted to leave, and they said no. And so he said, well, the chief of police said, well, a mob is forming, and I don't have time to be fooling with poor white trash and niggers. I got 22,000 people in the city I need to care for. So my dad said, are you going to protect us or not? They said, absolutely. He said, no. My dad said, I'll get my own protection. So he had my sister call three of his friends, and she said, quick, bring your guns. The mob is coming to lynch us and burn the house down, and call other black people. And from that, of course, they blocked off the street and stuff, but black people came from through people's back porches and through the fields and backyards. And at one point, they had to have about 30 or 40 black people, black men, in neighbors' houses, on their porches, in trees, and on our roof. Wow. And needless to say, the chief of police must have radioed to that group of 30 or 40 or 100 black white men who were coming down that they were in for trouble. And so they never showed up. And in the interim, I remember very clearly that my dad said, if you had ever asked him what he thought the worst scenario would have been, it never would have been that in Bogalusa, because Bogalusa was an independent southern town where they had a factory, the box factory, and a paper mill. And so black people were independent. They were not farmers or sharecroppers. They worked in the factories. And so we had a taxi stands, and we had a good school system that was segregated. We had restaurants or cafes. And so we're independent. We're not dependent on the land. And so it made us a unique place.
Remember those instances yourself firsthand?
Some of them. I was off at school. I had just gone off to college when this happened.
I see.
This happened in about 1965.
And you had six children in your family, right?
Yes.
You had, I mean, that's a lot. And then you go off to college. You went to Syracuse, right?
And I remember one time when we were in southern towns and probably other places, the Navy, the Army used to come through and, right, if you were a senior, you take the test. I'm coming in and you have to take the test to see if you can go, if you were going to the Army or you qualified. And I remember we were in the dining room and they passed out this test. And I didn't take the paper. And so the sergeant, whoever he was, said, you're supposed to be able to take this test. I said, no, I'm not taking the test. He said, why not? I said, because my dad, my mom and daddy sending me to college. I said, I don't need to take the test.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he went to the principal.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So he went to the principal and said that. But my dad said that what was striking to them is that he turned to my mother after the chief of police left, and he said, well, what are we going to do? And she said, we're not leaving our house. She said, I just want to get my children out. And I was in college, but they called my brothers and sisters together and said, well, you know, we got this situation here. And so you probably won't ever see us again, but we want you to know why we're doing this. That we believe that this is the right thing to do, and that we're standing up so you have a better chance in life to do what you need to do to make life better, not only for you all, but for black people in Bogalusa and throughout the country. And so know that we love you, that we cared about you, done the best we could for you. And the first car that arrived, they grabbed my brothers and sisters and put them in the back seat of the car. And we had a two-car garage that was open, and you could drive in and drive straight through. And they drove my brothers and sisters through the backyard across to the next corner. And one part of the corner was blocked off, but the far end was not. And so they drove them down there and took them to this place. And they turned all the phones off in the black community. But my brothers and sisters, I think they never really got over that traumatic effect. Because they didn't call my parents. They didn't hear anything for about two or three days. And so when they left, they just left with the idea that their parents were going to be killed.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was horrible experience. I once asked Megas Everett's daughters and a couple other civil rights leaders' children if they ever had any what you call post-traumatic syndrome from civil rights events. And they said, yeah. I remember my youngest sister used to tell me she was married with children before she could stop having nightmares about things happening to my parents. That's one of the things that a lot of people don't understand was the traumatic effect that the civil rights movement had on families and children in the South and throughout the country, for that matter.
Well, and as you mentioned, Edgar Medver's family, he was shot in their driveway right outside their home.
And our good friend, Dory Latner, who the senator knows, was the last, Dory Latner's father, the Latner sisters. And Dory was the last person to be seen with Mary Everett. She was in Mississippi, and she was in NAACP, and they had been doing some work. And they went out to dinner, and Mary Everett drove her home. She had to be about 16 or 17. And so she said, okay, Mary, I'll see you tomorrow. He let her out and drove home, and when he opened the door, they killed him. So she was the last person to be with him and say anything to him before he was killed.
Well, this is such an important point that you and Chuck make here, Maria, because this is not ancient history. Even I remember it. In 1961, my father drove us to New Orleans, and we stopped somewhere in Louisiana. I can't remember where, and we pulled into a restaurant, and it said members only. And I said to my father, it's members only, Dad. And he looked at me and he said, we're members. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, wow, how cool is he? He belongs to restaurants in Louisiana. And I remember the guy opening the little window, mm-hmm. you know, the little thing in the door and looking out at us and welcoming him up, you know, giving us a great welcome in. And we ate lunch there. And it wasn't until years later that I understood what that really meant. So it wasn't ancient history. And tell me if I'm wrong here, Chuck, but I seem to remember that your sister's car was firebombed only a few years ago.
Well, there were a couple of incidents. One of the things was that it was on Martin Luther King Parade, Martin Luther King birthday. And prior to that, maybe 10 years, maybe 8 years, my parents' house burned down. They burned to the ground, and my parents had a big house at the time, a large house. They had moved out to the city and had built a big 18, 19-room house and a big yard and everything. And they were at church one evening at Bible church, and they came back, and somebody called them, and I told them that the house was on fire. And for the longest time, people would say, oh, do you think that was that they burned the house down and stuff? And one of the things that had happened at one point was they would have lightning and strikes and things, and it had knocked the TV out a couple of times. So I just assumed initially that something must have started and ignited the spark. But later, more and more people were just absolutely convinced that that house was burned down, and we lost absolutely everything. And so they, my parents rebuilt the house, and this time they put a fire roof, roof on the house, and they threw cocktails on the roof, but they didn't burn. It wouldn't ignite. And my sister's car was sitting out there, and they took him and threw fire bombs in it and burned it completely up. And so then after that happened the second time, I went back and rethought it. And as my mom and my sister, you know, somebody did burn our house down on purpose. And it was just tragic because we lost absolutely everything. All the history of the, you know, our parents' house had been the Civil Rights Center in Bogalusa for the deacons. And, of course, the deacons were the first black group to carry guns in the Civil Rights Movement. And the deacons, my dad taught at the first chapter of the deacons after situation where they had the civil rights workers in the house. And so the first chapter of the Deacons for Defense and Justice came out of Bogalusa. We know that we had all the history and everything. We kept everything in there. On top of that, we had all our family stuff. You know, I was a kid who I can't remember when, since I was probably 10 or 12 years old, took pictures. So I had like 30 scrapbooks, family scrapbooks I've been taking. And just everything burned up. All our graduation pictures, our diplomas. It is a tragic experience when you have a fire and you lose everything. Because basically what you do is that you lose your entire history.
Mm-hmm.
It is, you have nothing to go back to. You don't have any pictures, any Bibles, and anything, if everything burns up. And so not only did our personal family items burn up, but all so much of the things that we had done in the Civil Rights Movement, core caps and shotguns that people had given, everything burned up. And sometimes even now we'll think about something and we'll say, remember that so-and-so? We had a... one thing, my parents had bought some shoes when my brothers and sisters were small, and they had baby shoes, and they my brother wore them, and then my youngest sister wore them. They were just baby shoes, and my aunt sent them off and had them bronze. And so all of a sudden, we just lost it. It's absolutely nothing. So it is just psychologically some of the things that can happen to you. It's just you just have to regroup and say it's for a this is for a bigger cause than what we have. And that
did they
of course,
ever
have
investigate that?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. And of course, they claimed that they could not determine what happened. You know, that was during that. There was still a time, and Bogalusa was one of the seats of the Klan for a very, very long time. And so all that was still going on.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, Chuck, go ahead.
Yeah, and of course, if people want to get some idea about the Deacons for Defense and stuff, HBO did a movie with Forrest Whitaker and Ozzie Davis, and Forrest Whitaker portrays my dad in that movie. But it's a very interesting movie in terms of the civil rights movement and people taking a different stand besides besides being nonviolent, but being self-defense. That became very, very important.
Is that Deacons for Defense film? Lucy?
Yes.
Okay. I think that's on Showtime.
Yeah,
you should watch it. You know, it's so important to point this stuff out, Chuck, because if you don't, you know, I think if somebody doesn't point these things out to you, you don't naturally understand them. I grew up as a young child in North New Jersey. North New Jersey had the highest African-American population in America at that time, the highest percentage of African-Americans. Never had a black teacher. Never saw a black policeman, never saw a black fireman, didn't see a black city worker unless he was picking up trash. And, you know, just that never made an impact on me until I moved to very, very white Montgomery County, Maryland, where I spent the rest of my life growing up. And then I started to realize it. I was like, wow, 60% of North was African-American, but there were no black policemen. There were no black teachers. There were no, you know, so if somebody doesn't point it out to you, you know, I'm almost embarrassed that I was that obtuse. But, you know, as a child, I just thought, you know, that's the way.
And the opposite thing happened for me. I grew up in a segregated town. Like I said, we were a good school, and we went to state competitions, and we always placed and, you know, be it in music, be it in debate, be it in whatever. And so I went to a segregated school and never had a white teacher. I say today that my brothers and my brother, my youngest brother, my youngest sister integrated the white high school. And sometimes when we go home now, it's different with my nieces and nephews, but I'm one of the people, since I left Bogalusa, I went to Southern, and because my dad and the governor had a falling out over the days of testing and the boycott, I got kicked out of Southern University in the middle of the night and ended up going to school in New York, Syracuse, where I became the first black student body president. But anyway, one of the things that's interesting is when I go home and I go to with my sister or my mama, even when my dad was alive, I go with him. My dad was the first black supervisor in the plant there, Crown's Elderback. But everybody knew my dad. And so I'm the only person, when I go home, I don't know anybody white. I know some white people now because they are close to the family and stuff. But my brothers and sisters, my oldest sister and brother lived in Bogalusa. My brother worked at the factory. So they all have some kind of this. They know people. I know nobody who's white in Bogalusa. I know them because I go someplace and I'm with my dad and he'll say, this is my son or my sister. This is my other brother from Washington. and say, oh, yeah, we know your family. You know, it's just like night and day. And so we have those kinds of differences.
Yeah, and, you know, again, it was just the opposite for me in North New Jersey. I grew up in my Italian grandparents' home when I was little. My grandmother was Northern Italian, so she did what a lot of black people did. You know, she passed. She wouldn't speak Italian. She had blonde hair and blue eyes, so she didn't want people to know she was Italian. My grandfather had a third-grade education, spoke four languages, wasn't very good at English, and my grandmother wouldn't even talk to him in Italian. She'd say, speak English. I'm an American. I don't understand what you're saying. You know, I think part of that is because she didn't like my grandfather that much. But, you know, but yeah, it was, you know, and we just thought it was a natural thing. And, of course, we had a vigilante in our neighborhood who everybody thought was a horrible, horrible man. I think maybe this is why I understand Donald Trump a little better than some people. They all thought he was a horrible man, but he kept black people, he kept people of color out of our neighborhood. And the white people were fearful of those people. But you know, so they supported him.
What is very interesting, and you made an interesting point, is that you talked about your grandparents and them being Italian, and that because she could pass as non-Italian, there were some privileges as long as she didn't talk.
Right.
If she went someplace and carried you all, they would think that somehow you all were part of it, maybe your mother or somebody worked there, and she was taking you all to the store with her so y'all could go buy some ice cream or something. And that's a very interesting thing that a lot of people don't understand, that there's, at some point in time there were Italians who passed because they didn't want to be Italians. And right. If they could pass, they did, because it made different privileges.
They did. And, you know, so ignorance is so much a part of racism, you know, not being able, not associating with people of different races. So really not. So understanding all the lies about them, all the myths, all the prejudices.
Yeah.
And I guess I was lucky in the fact that my mother's family believed all of them. But my father was this egalitarian man that really thought everybody was equal. Women, yeah, regardless of your religion, where you came from, who you were. And so, you know, I got to see both sides of it. But, you know, and I love my grandmother dearly. And this is a hard thing for white people, I think, is that at some point you have to say, yes, she was wonderful to me, but she was a bigot. And that was wrong. And, you know, and we have to deal with that. And I think we have a hard time dealing with it.
My good friend, that many people will remember, Jerry Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry Clark was just on the right side of everything. And he grew out of a family where his father was a total bigot and racist. And his mother was totally different. He said it was like, he doesn't even understand how they could have been married together. It was just so hateful and so full of racism.
Yeah.
He said, but their mother was different, and she would not let them be like that.
Yeah.
My mother,
I don't want to interrupt you, but my mother worked in all-black school. But when I was a kid, I had a sister that was 10 years older, and she taught me how to hand dance. I used to hand dance in the basement with her and her girlfriends. So I came to Washington and I entered it, you know, it was a dance contest. And the only girl that I'd ever seen hand dance was Teresa Bennett. And she was black. And so Teresa and I won the dance contest. And we got our picture on the front of the newsletter for the school. My mother put herself into a self-induced coma. She couldn't believe that I was holding a trophy on the front page of the little newsletter with this black girl, who, by the way, grew up to be the district attorney for Montgomery County. I mean, she was quite a successful person. But, yeah. You know, and it never dawned on me that that would be a problem, you know. But yeah, I came home and I said to my sister, "What's up?" And she goes, you're not gonna believe it, because my mother worked in a black school where she loved the children. And we used to say to her, "Mom, what do you think happens to them when they turn 18? Right. You know, you love these kids." But she didn't see black people. She saw children when it came to school.
Sure.
But she was afraid other than that. And you know, and that's the horrible thing about racism.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
that it perpetuates so many myths. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So wait, just as an aside, what is hand dance?
Hand, like a jitterbug.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
you know,
like
this was
a form of jitterbug.
Yeah,
but
like
the beat's
I was
different.
In middle school, right, and this was in the days when we were moving away from Motown and starting to listen to the Beatles, and you know,
it was like rock and roll, dancing to rock and roll,
right? And people didn't hold hands anymore. They kind of danced in independent of one another. So a lot of them didn't know how to do it. But Teresa, well, obviously Teresa and I were the best hand dancers in the school. But
sure.
And that's why I chose her. You know, I never ever thought about it. I just went.
Yeah.
Here's a girl that knows how to hand dance, you know, let's do it.
Oh,
and,
great.
Yeah. And let's, you know, and that, I got to tell you, that's one of my favorite stories about racism, is that my son told me one day that this kid on his soccer team named Zach had scored this amazing goal. And he was about 7 or 8 at the time. And I said, there were 2 Zachs on the team. And I said, was it white Zach or black Zach? And he said, I don't know what color he was. And I thought to myself, how could that be? Because that's like one of the first things when I was growing up, the first thing you noticed about a person was what sex they were. And then the next thing you noticed was what color they were, you know? And I thought, well, God, maybe there's hope. Maybe there's hope.
There is hope.
Well,
and Chuck, that's the final question I wanted to ask, Chuck, is what did you think about our country when George Floyd was murdered?
Yeah.
I thought it was an evolution, that we began to evolve to a new level. I think the thing was, and one of the interesting things I think about the civil rights movement and back then and today is that when George Floyd was murdered, people could see that. They watched that. You could, you saw it live. When Emmett Till was killed, you saw the pictures, but you didn't identify with. When Kenny Goodman and Swartz were killed, you just see the pictures or hear the papers. But when George Floyd was killed, you watched that man die.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And even if you didn't want to leave, you saw it. You connected with it. And it was just horrible. One of the things that changed part of the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights Movement was when King, number one, when King used those young children to march after being arrested, and people saw young black kids in Birmingham with those hose pipes and dogs being put on them, and the country they changed. Everybody started to come down there. And the Vietnam War, when people saw what they did to those villages, and the fact that mothers were losing their sons, and they could feel, you knew that. And so there was a connection there. And George Floyd was a connection for everybody in this country, one way or another. And for the young people, it's a new revolution. It's like being here to see a new revolution take place, that people have grown and that modern technology make things different. And you can't turn your back on it. If you're a human being, if you believe in social justice, if you believe in equality for all people, then you know wrong is wrong, and you see wrong, you saw wrong, and you made a decision that I am not going to stand by and just do nothing.
Yes.
And I think that's the importance of technology, being able to put things on your cell phones, being able to see those kinds of things, and just show it all over the world.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great way to end the show. Thank you so much, Chuck, for being with us again.
What a true honor.
I gotta tell you, yeah, it is an honor. And I got to tell you something, Chuck. You know, to be the senator for the District of Columbia has involved many amazing experiences, and I've made many amazing friends, and you, sir, are right at the top of the list. So thank you so much for being on the show.
I certainly appreciate that. It is always a pleasure to be with you, Senator. One of the events we're doing right quick for Black History Month is on the 22nd. We're going to do a Zoom call, Black Pioneers in the Fight for Statehood.
Great. How do people tune into that, Chuck?
We'll talk about Julia Hobson and Josephine Butler and Hilda Mesa and not just all those people, and some new fighters too.
Nice.
Good.
Yeah.
Well,
thanks for sharing that.
And thank you again. And tonight we're gonna leave you with a song by a guy that I saw the first rock concert. Well, I don't know if it was the rock concert. First concert I ever went to featured this man, the King of Soul, James Brown. And we're going to leave you with the song today, I'm Black and I'm Proud. And this goes out to Chuck Hicks, an amazing, one of the many amazing Washingtonians that I've gotten to know, and everybody celebrating Black History Month. Maria, you want the last word?
As always, Chuck, thank you for everything that you've done for your entire life and for the betterment of our country. And hopefully we're turning a corner. Hopefully.
And thank you all for the power of radio, the media.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chuck.
That gets the word out. It's all important. Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Give the people their right to vote.